After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
Hey, dear listeners. Just a note on the production of this episode. I was really excited to start the first part of our Movie Magic series, which will be our discussions on films and whatnot. And while I am pretty pleased with the content of this episode, I do want to take a second to apologize for some of the audio issues you will encounter listening to this one. I'm really sorry about some of the limitations of my editing ability at this time. But also, I was pulling the audio for this one off of a meeting I was using, and I think a lot of it was just lost due to internet connection issues and whatnot. So I did my best to try to preserve the content and try to make it as listenable as possible, but there will be a lot of pops, skips, and I did my best to, you know, piece things together, but I need to apologize up front for some of that, and I hope it doesn't take away from your ability to enjoy this one. So once again, I apologize for the audio issues. Let's move to the episode. Hey folks, welcome back to the Greenhouse. Today we'll be doing something a little different. You know, you've heard enough of me and my guests, you know, talk about doom and gloom. And while my analysis has not changed, I figured it's time to take accountability. I know on a previous episode we did last year, I talked about atoning for my sins as a formal Marvel fan, but I thought that wasn't enough. And I wanted to start a film discussion series here on the podcast. Still not quite sure what we're going to call it. But joining me today are returning guests and contributors, Gabby and Sky.
Hello, this is Gabby. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah, Gabby and Sky.
Hi, this is Sky.
I gotta pay for those like royalty-free sound effects at some point. I've been saying I was gonna do it for like years now.
I should just do them for you, then you don't have to pay for them, and it's my voice.
That's true. That's true.
Horrible sound effects.
No. Even better. I get to use them, and then let's like license them out so that everyone else pays us a royalty for them.
I don't think anyone wants to hear me do. Bow, 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 bow.
It's funny, actually.
I would buy it. If I had a reason to.
We're gonna bring ringtones back in.
That's exactly
the ringtones.
We'll charge you 25 cents a pop to use it.
Are those back rings, what are they, like you call someone and it like does it in your ear at you? And what are they called? Are they called back rings? Like, you know, you call somebody and they could set something, so instead of you hearing the dial, like the dial
phone,
like calling, it would like scream a like awful sounding noise in your ear. It was supposed to be a song. Yeah, bring that back.
They still got that in some countries.
No,
like I think in India, I forgot if I'm misremembering this or not, but like you could pay to have a licensed song as your personal ringtone. Or no, not your ringtone. No, it's your dial tone. So like when you're calling someone, instead of like hearing that like beep beep, it's like a licensed song that like is theirs.
Which is insane.
Oh my God.
I mean, nothing's more insane than when we were at Costco a few months ago and this lady had the Real Slim Shady as her ringtone, like middle-aged white lady. And we were literally just so confused and just looking everywhere. And it's like, she has that. That's her ringtone. Oh, okay.
Like the last person you expect, her and her husband raided the Capitol on January 6th. Look at time. You know what I mean? So again, you can never judge a book by their cover, you know.
Just by their ringtone.
Oh my God. If you had Tone song, what would you pick?
Don't know. I haven't had a ringtone in quite some time. And I can't imagine me liking any song that I would want to constantly hear. So, I don't know.
Well, it's not a
How
ringtone.
about?
Like, his dial tone is like when I'm calling you,
Oh,
and then
my
until
dial
you pick
tone.
up the phone, that's what I hear.
Oh, that okay. No, that's more annoying, and I definitely would have one of those if I could. Well, now that my phone is also my work phone, I can't do anything crazy, but I would probably have like WAP or something just to.
Wait, specifically for me, I feel like it would have to not just be WAP, but the Ben Shapiro version of WAP. Yes,
There you go.
which
There you fucking go.
it's like I feel almost bad because I'm like, these two women make this song and it's catchy as hell, and my fucking brain is like, Ben Shapiro version? That's the only
Let's
like
ask
random.
P word.
Yes.
I'm gonna cut that in when I edit it. I'm gonna cut that in.
Whores in this house. There's some whores in this house. There's some whores in this house. There's some whores in this house.
I said certified freak.
House. There's some
7 days a week.
There's some
wet ass P word. Make that pullout game weak. Yeah.
It's
Yeah.
Felicia, yeah, dude.
Yeah.
Oh
Yeah.
my
Yeah.
God.
You effing with
That's
some
so
wet ass
angry.
P
It's so good, man.
Oh my gosh.
He really just like told us that he does not get his wife's pussy wet and was very adamant about it too, which is just
That's not
insane
true.
to me.
My wife's a doctor.
He
She does not have a medically accurate dry ass P word. Yeah. I can't believe. Oh my God. Okay. Of things that are actually good, like the Ben Shapiro WAP edit. Let's actually get to the subject of today's film discussion. And I'm actually very glad that you dragged us out to go see this movie. I want to say a couple weeks ago now. I'd been commenting about how film, especially lately, is really saturated with like things that are designed to be big blockbusters. And everything that isn't a Disney franchise or like superhero adjacent, is either like direct to stream now or is in the A24 lineup. And the A24 lineup has been pretty good. I haven't had a chance to like really been, go back to the movies. So when you invited us out to go see Everything Everywhere All at Once, be like positively influenced. I'd heard a lot of good things about it on Twitter and on the internet, but I didn't know if like this would be the thing to get me to cinema again. And I'm pleased to say you were absolutely right. This was probably the best ways to rediscover movie magic. So, since you were the first one among us to see it, what were your first impressions of the film? Before we really get into like the plot summary and things. By the way, folks, spoiler, shut off this episode, throw your phone at the wall, go get tickets, watch it first, and then listen to this, if anything.
Like, if you haven't seen it, why haven't you seen it yet? That seems like a you problem because we've already seen it at least twice. So think about that.
It is 100% a movie that is best going in blind. Like, if you know what's going to go on, it will take away from your experience. But on that, actually, I love seeing any movie that I see a trailer for and it looks weird as hell. I'm like, yeah, okay. Like, we're going to go watch that movie now. Like, and then I don't want to learn anything else about it. So like I like going in, and the only thing I knew about this movie was that the directors who had directed Swiss Army Man had made it, which is a weird ass movie. You guys have not seen it yet. It's a bizarre movie. I like it, but it's weird as fuck. And so I was really excited to go check it out. And like my first impressions, like I remember, like I walked out of the theater and I was like, I can't even articulate right now how I'm feeling about this movie because there were so many pieces and things to it that I need a good amount of time to actually process, like, everything I just watched. But not in a way that was like, oh, this movie was so deep and heavy and like, oh, I just need a bunch of time to unpack all of that. But more so in a way, like, it made me feel good at the end, but also made me feel like there were a lot of things to think about, which I feel like is a very hard line to get because most movies fall on one end or the other. And it can be very annoying to walk out of a movie and feel like miserable. And like, there's a lot of stuff you didn't, like, you're not sure how to unpack. Like, no shade on anyone who likes The Lighthouse, but that's how I feel about The Lighthouse. Good movie, but I left going, I feel icky and gross inside. So Everything Everywhere All at Once is like the opposite type of thing where you walk out and you think like, I don't even know what to feel, but I know it's positive things. Like, I know I feel good about this.
So just to quickly interject, you were talking about some of the Daniels' previous work. An interesting past work of theirs that I think the audience would like to know. They directed the music video for Turn Down What, if anyone remembers that. If anyone remembers just what the fuck fest that music video was. So knowing that they had their hands in that and then this movie, I think it's a natural progression of that kind of chaotic, surrealist art style for them.
Yeah, I'd say absurdism. They like lean so hard into absurdism, which I found recently I actually enjoy as a genre. I didn't think I did, but I'm realizing as I'm looking at a lot of stuff I enjoy, I'm like, oh shit. Oh shit, you like absurdism. You're one of those kind of people.
Sky, first impressions?
It was amazing and confusing, and there were so many parts that I knew at the first like watch I needed to watch it again, and I honestly want to see it again because there's just so many things to unpack, and it goes so fast, which you feel like you are the main, like, with the main character because everything's going as fast as it is for us. And I don't know, I just haven't seen a really good movie in a very long time, and it was so refreshing to see what
that's how I felt. Like, I think I remember, like, in the first 15 minutes the kind of like way inserted into the film without much exposition, without much of like a, how do I describe this? Like, you know how like when films like really dwell on like setting up the world for like the start of the movie, and the story might not even begin like an hour in.
Mm-hmm.
They just like threw us right into it. And despite like the kind of, you know, fast pace and like the really eclectic style of the film, what it actually did surprisingly well, and what the films I hate these days do, is it didn't dwell on exposition. Like, the exposition was probably 5 minutes in the middle of the movie of how like the science fiction aspect of it works, and they didn't really dwell on it too much. But I think what they spent a lot of time doing adequately was setting up the themes of the movie, setting up the relationships between the characters, and focusing on those, because that's really what the story of the film is about. It's about a relationship that family members have, that people have to themselves, that people have to their choices. And focusing on that aspect is what made it so physically pleasing to me. Is it cares about its audience getting the right impressions from the movie, but it trusts the audience to keep up. It doesn't need to talk down to or explain or baby the audience. And then on the second watch, for me at least, it was good to, like, you know, see like that the emotional impression the movie left on pretty much the same, if not like repeated, watching it the second time. But then I was able to actually like sit back and enjoy all like the presentation elements And another nice trick that I picked up on the second one that the filmmakers were using is Chekhov's gun was, or I don't know if that's like the right way to refer to the phenomenon, but the final fight that happens in the stairwell of the movie, that is the garden and the tax like building. So the settings are kind of set up in a Chekhov's gun style. So there's like a linear way your brain can keep up with everything, even though everything's really fucked up and moving fast. And I know I'm sounding really technical and I'm focusing on this a little too much, but I'm saying like they, for as complex as the plot of this is, as far reaching as the concept is from a science fiction standpoint, they use some pretty simple techniques to make it easy for the audience to keep up. And trusting the audience to keep up is what set these directors apart from something like a superhero blockbuster or something like that.
Yeah, I think it also trusts the audience to keep up. And it also, there's a lot of like really smart scripting. And the way that it's written, mm-hmm. there's a lot of really smart like transitions. So specifically the scene I'm thinking of, there's a bit where the Waymond and Evelyn, the husband and wife, are having a conversation about their marriage in the van, right? Like, and he's talking about divorce and about how she's never really there with him, and how like when he's talking to her, it's like she's not really listening. And there's a lot of really clever like transitions in that moment. Like, you know, she goes from, because at the same time she's fighting like Alpha Deidre, right? She's mm-hmm. having that like fight on one plane, and then she's having a conversation about her divorce on the other plane, which are two conflicts, right? But of very different natures. And the way that they transition between those scenes, it's like he's like, it's like you're never really here, you're always getting pulled away. And then they transition to the scene where she goes back to fighting Deidre, with Deidre pulling her out of the car. And it's a very mm-hmm. like, it helps you keep up. And also when you look back and you rewatch it, it just feels very clever. Like when you notice it, you're like, oh, I feel smart, like I see what you did there. Or he says like, I'm not trying to hurt you, and then when she slashes right back and she like hits her head on the steering wheel, and it's mm-hmm. like she's physically being harmed in one dimension, and he's saying like he's not trying to hurt her here. And it's a very like clever way to let you keep up without, again, like belaboring it, like you said, like it's not hyper complex, or it doesn't need all these like hoops to be jumped through. It's really simple techniques that make it feel smooth, and then also let the audience, as you notice those details, go, oh, that's clever, I like that. Which I love when I watch movies that I can pick up on things that it makes me feel like I'm smart. Like, I'm like, it makes me feel good. It's mm-hmm. like an additional good feeling in a viewing experience, but it did it really well.
Yeah, I think a lot of like movies that are supposedly good and like classics and everything, they're fucking confusing and they're weird. And like some of the times, like, you feel the disconnect that was in the room while either writing or producing or directing or filming. Like, there's just something. And this just feels so seamless. Like, the relationships are realistic. Like, the most funny thing is when she told Joy that she was fat, instead of being like, oh, I'm sorry that I didn't tell your grandpa about who you are. It's just like, that is realistic. Like, you are going to tell me that like someone hasn't had that exact conversation with their parents. I probably have that conversation where I'm trying to like divulge about myself in a like serious moment. And it's like, haha, but if you weren't fat, maybe this wouldn't be happening. I'm like,
which also this is something I wanted to interject into, because considering the time of the year, it is Asian American Pacific Islander Awareness Month. What the film did well, because there's like a lot of stink pieces and what I consider bad works recently about identity and like different ethnic backgrounds in film. And what I appreciate about this film is that it didn't lampshade or hyper focus on, look at me, I'm Asian. It just let the characters be who they were without mentioning it. And the cultural commentary, or the, you know, the kind of progressive critiques of cultural behaviors and things like that, are not imposed on the characters by the story or by other people. It's the characters coming to those conclusions themselves, not even using like academic language to, you know, to critique it. It's them talking about their feelings and how they were impacted by this stuff, which I think is the right way to approach identity and storytelling if it is to be done any kind of way. But that's another digression there. But definitely, like, to what Sky was saying, it's focused on human interaction and human perception in a really honest and relatable way. And this is a point that I didn't know when to bring up because we still got to get into the plot summary of this, but I think it's worth maybe discussing this point a little bit. Is Daniel Kwan, who is one of the Daniels, when he was talking about the production of this movie, they wanted to work on a multiverse concept, but he felt like he'd been beaten to the punch by like Into the Spider-Verse and Rick and Morty. And also, they wanted to develop a main character who had undiagnosed ADHD because that's something he discovered about himself. And I'm not sure to what extent this colored the writing process, because another thing about this too is at no point do any of the characters say, or does the movie pitch in and say, by the way, this character has undiagnosed ADHD, look at how bad it is for them. They kind of go through it on her perspective and how she's bewildered and, like, you know, struggles to focus with things and stuff like that, instead of that kind of infantilizing and patronizing view we sometimes have of mental illness and disabilities and things like that. And in fact, not addressing any of it explicitly or directly, but just, like, you know, really subtly looking at it and letting the characters and the audience come to the conclusions is a pretty powerful technique in how they deployed it. So I wanted to get you guys' thoughts on that.
I mean, I think I struggle with this because I don't know much about, I am not an expert in, or don't know much about, like, people who might have undiagnosed ADHD, or, like, that's an experience that they might have, right? I only know, like, mm-hmm. very basic, like, I've Google searched and know the symptoms type of thing. So I definitely can't speak to that very much. But I do think in relation to that, like, keeping it person-centric and the story being, like, a very person-centric story and about relationships and that, like, being the core root of it and it never losing that, despite the fact that it was doing all the science fiction kind of off the wall stuff. Something when I was talking, I was thinking about is how there are no actual antagonists in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's set up at first, it seems like everyone might kind of be like, she's not an antagonist, but she's like the bad guy, right? Because she's not nice to her daughter and she's kind of the reason their relationship is falling apart because she can't, like, devote herself to anything. And then we kind of transition into Joy. The version, one version of Joy is the villain, right? We need to defeat her because she's the villain. And then it's recognized that, like, no, that's not necessarily true. And as it, like, kind of builds like this, it really comes centered back to, like, these are individuals and they're people and they're not necessarily bad or good or, you know, anything like that, which I think a lot of media tries to do, but it ends up becoming off. It's kind of creepy sometimes, or maybe, like, everyone exists in the middle and no one's, and it comes off too, like, rigid. And I think this movie was really, really good at capturing, like, people as they are, but without sacrificing entertainment, which is another thing. I think movies that tend to be very, like, these are humans and this is how humans act, and the kind of, like, real life type of dialogue is good, but also loses something because it is still a movie and it is a piece of entertainment. And, like, if I wanted to watch two regular ass people have a conversation, I would just, like, go to the grocery store or, like, sit at a park. Like, I don't, like, that's not what I'm going to when I go see a movie. So they somehow struck, and I keep saying, like, balance is moving, that's kind of a theme too, but, like, they struck this incredible balance between feeling very grounded and real with the people that they were talking to, people very person-centric, but also still, like, wildly entertaining and fun, which is amazing. Like, it's an amazing feat to be able to do both, but that's I took us in a different direction a little bit, but
that's fine.
I can totally see the ADHD aspect of it. It's very subtle, and I mean, that's the thing. If you have ADHD, it's not, you might feel like different, but you don't know that you're different until someone tells you. So obviously she has been told all of the time, like, pay attention, come back, like, focus on one thing, do this. And that's something that she struggled with. I know a lot of people with ADHD also do. So I can see where that would be like a little slight thing in the background. But obviously, what are you going to do? Like, make her figure that out during this 24-hour period? And also, like, how unrealistic would that be for her to just figure out, hey, I might have ADHD? Like, most older people don't find out unless their children are diagnosed. But I do think the movie was amazing when it came to the human aspect. And at the end of the day, the final fight scene, where it was just like, don't fight, like, don't hurt them anymore, and how that all tied into the nature of the father, and just the fact that there were no bad guys. There were people doing what they felt they needed to do. But at the end of the day, it was all about human relationships and not about this, like, entity trying to destroy the entire world, even though, like, partially, yes, but, like, when you watch another movie, it's always like Hydra or something like that, like this big secret entity that's just doing some of this. And even if that is the first part of it, once you learn the human connection part, you're like, oh, I kind of understand why you did that. I probably would have. Can't say I wouldn't have, but like, I can't just like, it's just so different than other movies and their bad versus good and who gets to be bad and who gets to be good.
Oh yeah. And I think that's maybe to tie some of this together before we get to the plot summary. Like, what that point illustrates to me is like the fact that they use the subtext to make the commentary, as opposed to, like, you know, there's so many like, either in discussions you've heard this, or even in like TV and entertainment now, you'll see it where it's like, Evelyn's dad was shitty and this is why, or like they'll make a point of like making that the plot of an episode. And I think, like, you know, with some of these discussions, like even in the specific cultural context, you know, I can speak to some of this. Mental illness is stigmatized in Asian culture. You know, people tend to be undiagnosed because of the stigma. You know, rather than like beating people over the head with that point, just using the subtext of the story to let that be a conclusion people come to on their own, as opposed to something they're beaten over the head with, one is powerful for that, like, you know, the social context reason. But then two, it's actually a pretty powerful way of looking at why people hurt one another, because that's what like the film concludes in, is that, you know, to, in such a confusing and chaotic world, I think it's best that like we collectively reduce one another's pain so we can, you know, live in peace with one another. That's like what it ends with. And, you know, they go into like all the different reasons people are in pain and why they do shitty things. And through Evelyn's, she's able to like not give them what they want, but provide them with some aspect of kindness or some aspect of relief from their pain, that they stop fighting her and they come on her side. And even like the ending of the movie is powerful, where it's like her daughter, or sorry, Jobu Topaki, who's the final antagonist of the film, is someone who is like in deep existential angst because they don't know what to do. Especially like that is the problem of the film, Everything Everywhere All at Once, when you've seen eternity, when you've seen everything, how do you find meaning after the fact? And very powerfully, the film is like, it's a choice to make meaning of it, as opposed to finding an inherent meaning. So, with that being said, I think we can jump maybe into a quick plot summary. Who wants to kick us off?
I'm not even sure how to exactly summarize the plot. Again, I hope anyone who's listening has already seen it, so this stuff actually makes some semblance of sense, because I bet you it won't unless you have. But in a very broad way, it is about a woman who is confronted with the idea that they is confronted with the truth that there are there's a multiverse, right? And a multiverse version of herself has invented the ability to jump between these multiverses, and that there is a force that is coming or is trying to destroy the multiverse or destabilize it in some way, and that she is the version of herself that is most likely going to be able to stop that. Which is that summary. I remember that's almost I kind of cheated a little because I had read the summary of the film that was like on Google, and I remember reading that and thinking like that is such a it's almost like a disservice to the movie because it doesn't even touch on the things that it actually does. But if you're talking like a bare bones, just technically what it's about, like that is technically what it's about, right? It's
yeah, I think I don't know. I can kick us off maybe through it, and then we can interject as needed. Because what it starts with is, you know, there's the three main members of the family, which is Waymond, Evelyn, and their daughter Joy. The two of them run a laundromat and seem to be struggling financially. And basically, the plot is centered on them trying to run a New Year's party while trying to get their tax shit in order. And their grandfather is visiting her father, who's not proud of her, is visiting from China. And they're visited by their daughter, Joy, who is lesbian. And their grandfather doesn't know about that. So in the midst of all this chaos, she's trying to reintroduce Joy to her grandfather, as well as her girlfriend to him. And then she gets cut off at the last minute, causing a conflict. And that creates the first round of tension we observe. Joy and Evelyn, which is that she seems to be ashamed of her. And what Evelyn's not able to articulate, and what we are able to discern through the subtext, is that Evelyn has a strained relationship with her father and is trying to subconsciously shield her, but, you know, isn't doing it in the way, like, you know, we would come to expect, or in like an honest kind of way. So while that's going on, she's also in a very strained relationship with her husband. He's depicted as like a kind of pushover. Like, he's known as like very effete and dorky. When he's presented with conflict, he's very quick to like deflect to someone, or like find a way to like weasel his way out of those conflicts, if I'm not mistaken. So there, and he's trying to find a way to present his wife with divorce papers, because he's been on the receiving end of her anger for quite some time, it looks like. They get to the IRS, and it was her job to like file their taxes, but there was something wrong. So we are encountered by Jamie Lee Curtis. Folks, she is a force of nature in this film. I don't know if I'm going to sum this up. Gab, are you still there?
Yeah, sorry. My internet's getting a little wonky, so I'm trying to make sure it has less to do.
I can also jump in.
Yeah.
So at this point, she is at the IRS with her husband and her, first, she's on the way inside the IRS up the elevator, and her husband switches up and tells her that she's going to be in danger and that she needs to go to the closet, the janitor's closet, as soon as possible, and don't even talk to him about this. And she goes and she's like, well, I don't know what the hell is happening. So obviously has to go to her tax appointment, which is more important. And this is when she meets Jamie Lee Curtis' character. What is her name?
Deirdre Bobeardra.
Oh, yeah. Deirdre. And while she does that, she has instructions from her husband, which is... he's the alpha version of him, to switch her shoes around, do something weird. I can't remember what the third. And think about, imagine that she's in the janitor's closet while right. having earpieces on. And this is the first time she experiences verse jumping. And she is transformed, which is like one of the best parts of the movie. It's like all of the visuals. So like she is sucked into the janitor's closet. One version of her while the other one is still physically there. And she's talking to Alpha Raymond. And they are having a conversation. And this is the first time that she's doing... the split conversations where she is in one universe and also in her universe and is trying to keep up, but is getting confused throughout the entire time.
And also, like, not to interject here, so painfully, but the thing that gets her about this verse jumping process is she's basically reliving her life, but it's like a different choice, like a big life change would have happened that changed the trajectory of her life. And that's the concept of verse jumping in the movie, basically, where if the choices in your life were different, for you to have gained significantly different abilities, the alternate version of you that made those decisions will be connected to you in that way. And that's how verse jumping works. You gain their abilities.
But one of the coolest things I think about this multiverse theory is it's every single decision that you make creates mm-hmm. another universe. So there could be a parallel universe from me earlier who didn't take a nap and got some things done. Doesn't seem realistic, but like there could be. And that's the idea of it. So every decision that she has made or thinks she hasn't made, which if you don't make a decision, that is a decision. She has another universe that is connected with her. And through those different universes, she can gain their abilities, but it is something that is practiced for a very long time. Like it's not something that people should learn in like 5 seconds in the broom closet, but that's what she had to do. And she is with the alpha version of her husband, and he's trying to explain everything about the verses, about how she has to do this, or I don't know what the name of the villain is.
Well, yeah, so I can maybe quicken this a little bit, because like now I've got my thoughts together. So basically, the point of verse jumping is, one, you can get abilities. But the way it works in the movie, and this is what sets up the comedy, is to enter the universe where you have those abilities, you need to make drastically decisions from what you would normally make in the present. So there's like weird, funny shit you have to do to gain those abilities. So in one of the scenes, the guy has to give himself finger or paper cuts in his hand to try and get like a certain fighting ability. Or she has to tell like this, this person attacking her that she loves in like a really like cartoonish kind of way in order to like gain skills where she knows martial arts. And the other part of this is then Lynn's character, where she feels a lot of regret for not having made certain decisions in her life. And through living these lives with abilities, she gets caught up in like these versions of herself that she sees as more successful. So she's kind of like getting the point, but also getting sidetracked because she's feeling personally fulfilled, but she needs to use these abilities to fight Jobu Tepaki, who is basically a version of her daughter that in an alternate universe, she subjected to this verse jumping phenomenon so much that she saw him, basically. And Jobu Tepaki's character basically is that she doesn't necessarily want to kill her mother, but she wants to make someone feels what she feels, which is the sheer existential dread that comes with having seen eternity, as described in the film. And more broadly, you could even attribute that to like, you know, modern life in a way where, you know, if you're someone living in like a consumer society in a post-scarcity kind of way, you know, if you're surrounded by luxury, for instance, and you've sampled every pleasure, what would you derive meaning from? That's one way of looking at it. Let's say if you knew everything in the universe, you'd consumed all knowledge, what would you then derive and find meaning in your life? That's the existential question that was posed to this character, and it's caused severe existential dread. So she needs to like antagonistically experience the same thing with her mother. But Evelyn's dilemma is trying to relive all these lives where she made these different decisions. And what she comes to realize, and the threat that was posed to her at the start of the movie, as explained by Alpha Waymond, is, you know, if you keep experiencing everything, you are bound to go insane. And in a way, like, we see the strain of her holding it all together. And then is that in the universe, in all the universes, actually, her husband, Raymond, is the one who shows her the way, not necessarily of antagonistically combating everything, but in this, what he sees as his way through the world, which is to collaborate, to cooperate, to disarm people rather than to fight them. And trying that, actually able to solve all her problems in all these different multiverses. And then she approaches the final, you know, conflict with her daughter in that lens. And he admits that, like, you know what, maybe all of this is meaningless, but I want to make this matter with you and with everyone in my life. And that's actually a good place to fucking end it for both the story and for the plot line summary that I was trying to do there. But that's fundamentally, you know, what the film is about, is that, you know, conflict does not have to be the resolving these kind of embittered differences. And the problem of eternity is not one that can be solved necessarily with logic, but, you know, is one that humanistically is a problem of choice in a way. Enough high thoughts. That's enough there. I hope that wasn't too long-winded of a plot summary, by the way.
It was a little raccoon that controls a man like a monitor. needed to bring that up.
What?
It has nothing really to do with the plot, but I just think it's important to mention. It's important to me.
Mm-hmm.
As much as it's like, again, like the movie is very, has all these concepts and deep themes, but I like keep reiterating this. It's still like absurd and fun and ridiculous and goofy and like that. And like so funny. It's like,
it's
I love
so fucking funny.
It's so
oh
funny.
My God.
And so I feel like a basic summary of it, it's so hard because like doing a like basic summary of it makes it sound like either it's like going to be a very serious movie, right? But like it's not. And that's like part of what makes it so good. Because it's like a recognition that nothing matters, but also a recognition that everything matters. Like if nothing matters, then everything also matters.
Mm-hmm.
And making that you make a decision to make things matter, which is very important to me. That's like a personal, for me, it like speaks to me. That's how I like view the world. That's how I feel about the world. And so watching a movie that was able to articulate that in like such a fun and interesting way was so nice. It was so good.
And I mean that is like the real main core of themes in the movie. I'm just going through the outline here because I think you also picked up on some good themes here. One thing I recall, Gabby, actually was the one scene that you felt like, you know, very impressed by, one where Waymond is outlining his philosophy to Evelyn about, you know, how he fights is not through fighting, it is through his nature of cooperation. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, that's the part that makes me cry. And it made me cry both times I watched it. And it's specifically when he says like something to the effect of like he flat out says like this is how I fight. And it kind of shows all the things he does, like all the little things he's been doing throughout the movie. And he's been made out to be this mousy, kind of like easily pushed, like easy pushover. I'm probably hearing my dog shaking. But he comes off as a pushover, right? Like he's so, he's not very smart, or he makes bad decisions, or it's kind of how he's framed throughout the entire movie. And he's a source of a lot of comedy because of that. But in that moment, it's that recognition that like it is so powerful to not only collaborate, but also just to be a force of good and to be a force of positivity. And like some of it's just he laughs with people and he makes people laugh and he does just nice things. And it's his way of persevering. And it spoke to me very personally, right? Like it just, I feel like if you're the type of person that fights in the way that Wayman does, it resonates really, really hard. Because it almost comes off too, like the way he frames it. I can't remember how the lines go, but the way it's framed is like, not only is it how he fights, but it's also how he exists in the world and how he perseveres and how he survives. Which is, you know, a lot of times when somebody's very nice, it's seen as a altruistic behavior, right? Or like, you're like such a good person kind of behavior. And with Waymond, it is, but it's also that this is how he found is the best way for him to exist in the world and to be the safest and to protect himself. Which resonates a lot. I don't even know how to express it again. Like this movie gets me on so many levels, but like that feels so important, right? Because I haven't seen that expressed in the way that it was expressed in that movie. And that being the thing that teaches Evelyn how to accomplish this goal and how to figure it all out is like so, it's so good because so many movies are out fighting and standing up and being difficult. And like Waymond is just not that kind of character. I just enjoy it a lot. Was rambling a bit, but
no, I stand by that. This is a husband movie.
And just like the addition to the googly eyes everywhere, like on the laundry, just everywhere you can see, it was not only was it that just like feel good moment of someone trying to put googly eyes on something, like that's the type of person they are, but also just trying to relieve a little bit of the stress, even though like Evelyn hated the googly eyes at first, like it became something that she just realized that is joyful and beautiful and one of the reasons why she loves Waymond. And it's super cute, honestly.
It's also kind of on that too. So Joy's girlfriend, whose name I definitely can't remember because she's so in the movie so little.
It's Becky.
Becky, okay, thank you.
Makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah. I think Becky's also so interesting too, because Joy and Evelyn are very similar characters. Like, that is something that's pointed out, that Joy is like her mother. And there's a scene at the beginning of the movie where Joy is trying to talk to Evelyn, and she says, like, yeah, Becky wants to help out. Like, she wants to help out with making dinner. And Evelyn's like, why would she want to do that? Like, she's so confused by it. And Joy's also confused by it. She's like, I don't know. She's just like that. And it's interesting because that's what Waymond is like, right? Like, Joy has inadvertently found somebody who is like her father, and she and Evelyn cannot understand them and why they behave the way that they behave. It was just another quick way to signal, like, the type of people that they are and the type of people they attract, right? Because Joy and Evelyn, you could be argued that they're, I mean, Evelyn points out, like, they're both difficult and hard-headed, and they're both, they go for things, and they fight, and they do all this stuff, and Waymond is the opposite, and she just can't necessarily understand how they get on together. And I just think it was a really, and it was just like another example of that, like, clever storytelling, where at the beginning of the movie there was this, like, little blip that drew our connection between Evelyn and Joy even stronger through a character, mm-hmm. like, through Becky, who's a character that shows up so little and has so few lines, but is just like Waymond. Even that scene where, like, at the end of the movie where Evelyn finally introduces Becky as Joy's girlfriend to her father, to Joy's grandfather and Evelyn's father, and they all leave, and it's just Becky and the grandfather standing there, and they do not speak the same language, and Becky is just kind of smiling at him, like, this is good, right? And it's that same vibe that Waymond has, and I think it's just a really good shorthand for connecting Evelyn and Joy even more. It's like a very clever, like, filmmaking thing to do.
Absolutely. I mean, all in all, it's just genius filmmaking, because it celebrates the depth of human emotion in a way that you just don't see these days. You just don't see anything, especially, like, in just one film alone, like, the depth of misery to elation, pride and shame, love and hatred in the same film from the same characters. So, like, the setup of the film allows for that, but then just how competently the directors accomplish it, and more specifically, I mean, about the casting. Let's give a shout out to the actors on this one. This was just out of 10 performances from the entire cast, I gotta say.
Honestly, if they don't sweep the Oscars and every other award show, I'm going to be disappointed like I am every year with the white-centric award shows. But, like, literally, I would be outspoken, because I have watched a lot of movies because of their, like, they were nominated for something or whatever. But, like, this is a movie that at first I heard very little about, and then I heard everything about. And it's so good. I haven't even heard someone have a, like, negative thought when it comes to this movie, because it's just so complex. Well, that person's stupid.
They are. That was the... I remember, like, as soon as we walked out of the movie theater, I said, near prophetically, I know some motherfucker is going to say Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness is better than this. And they showed up. They showed up on the internet. I didn't respond to any of it. But it's just surprising, like, the denial people have.
I think that people tend to do that. I mean, if something is popular, right? This movie definitely did. People tend to behave that way always, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
I don't make me happy. I'm not on Twitter. I don't use Twitter anymore. But that's neither here nor there. It just, I feel like they're gonna be angry, and I this might not be totally on topic, but where my brain is right now. It's also amazing that this movie is, like, also a kung fu movie. Like, that's very cool. Like, I don't have anything, like, profound to say about that, but, like, the fight scenes are fucking amazing. Like, that scene with the fanny pack.
The like, fan because the throwing dart scene. Oh my god!
God, I will watch it 100 times. It's so good.
I would be a part of a training group of people with fanny packs trying to learn all of those moves.
It's funny, right? Because I think after I went and watched Shang-Chi with a couple friends, I remember just thinking like, I need to watch some actual martial arts movies after this. I'm gonna, you know, say this was a great movie, not paying any honors to like any of the like, you know, treasures of martial arts cinema. So I took it on myself to rewatch the Ip Man series. I watched Hero, probably one of the best films of all time. And I'm still, you know, now I have this annoying new goal of wanting to develop expertise in martial arts film and exploitation films. But I was not expecting this to also be a martial arts film on top of everything else.
It truly does everything.
It does everything. Everything, mm-hmm. Everywhere, all at once. And I mean, again, like, if you're worried about the tickets being too expensive, let me tell you, folks.
You better go see a bad name. See,
if you want to see a grown man use a fanny pack as a throwing dart in a fight against five armed guards and win, that is worth two ticket prices alone. Might as well get yourself the overpriced popcorn while you're there.
Always.
Not to mention the man who played Wayman, which I cannot remember his name right now.
Ke-Hui Kwan, if I'm saying that right.
Yeah, he's also playing three different characters in this one movie. He's playing Alpha Wayland,
which is drastically different.
Yeah, he's like this highly competent, like kind of like intense guy. Then our Wayman, who is this nice and like kind of goofy, lighthearted, funny character. And then you have like the third Wayman, who's this, yeah, the businessman Wayman, who is got this suave kind of like energy to him, and he does all of them like perfectly. Like I cannot even begin to explain, like he does so well. And like on this too, I will say also, like we already talked about Jamie Lee Curtis being absolutely fucking amazing. She just is. The woman who also played Joy does an amazing job as well, like going from being just a normal, like her like Joy in the universe that we're in is this normal, pretty much normal type of person. And then you have like Joji Tsubaki, which is just this, she is like this otherworldly, completely unhinged kind of character. And her actress nailed both of those perfectly. Again, like far ends of the spectrum.
Just and also, are we not going to, as a society, start putting respect on Michelle Yeoh's name?
Are we going to start?
Like oh the scene God. When she was like famous and like a famous movie star, I'm like, yes, as she should be. Like all of that, the paparazzi, I'm like, yes, you deserve this, my love. You do.
Yeah,
we're not going to talk about the absolute legend Kong as grandpa.
He and like also change of the hat. When it comes to his different characters, which is just what makes this movie so amazing, because like the acting ability, especially when you think that Awkwafina was up for the role of Joy, and how that would have been the worst casting of someone ever, because Awkwafina does not have the range. She's not even funny. She's not even a good actress. She is a good actress because she acts like she's Black sometimes. But, like, other than that, like, she would never be able to pull off the outfits that were being like worn. Like the outfits literally just got me. I'm like, yes, the makeup, the whole costume department needs their fucking flowers, because every single Joy was so drastically different, and the way she could seamlessly like go into these different outfits and be these different Joys, but also be the same one. It's just wonderful, amazing.
On another point of potential casting too, I was reading that the movie was originally supposed to star Jackie Chan as kind of a of Wayman and Evelyn, and then they'd made a choice to eventually split it out into a husband and wife duo, which I think was a good decision. Yeah. And I also think that while I would love to see this movie with Jackie Chan in it, it would probably get dismissed as like a direct-to-streaming action movie that might not have gotten the attention it deserved. And actually getting, I'm really butchering this man's name, Ke Huy Quan. All Vietnamese people, I'm sorry for butchering your language and your name pronunciations. Hold me to account. I deserve all the hate I'm going to get. But he actually took a departure from acting for like a long time.
Yeah, because of film in a very long time.
Yeah, because like I think, you know, there's that. If anyone's seen the documentary "The Slanted Screen," documentary from a lot of veteran Asian actors talking about how like non-Asian actors, these like Asian stereotype roles, like Fu Manchu type characters, you were kind of relegated to martial arts cinema as like an antagonist for like a white lead or something like that. And I think like there's this, especially if anyone's been keeping up with all the cultural stink from recent years, I think a lot of hay has been made about representation in media. I don't keep up with it as faithfully as some do. But something I've always noticed is like in some of these discussions, it's always spoken about, you know, this angle of Hollywood doesn't want, you know, to seek out Asian talents. It as like one of, you know, one of the things I remember reading, and what always has been there for a while. There's several talents working in outside of Hollywood in excellent films, and you know, Michelle Yeoh being like the lead of this. Like if you thought like she movie, she has a whole body of work for you guys to check out. You know what I mean? So it's one of those things that I think. So is worth saying is that, you know, there's been a renewed interest in Asian cinema and Asians in cinema as a discussion. And I think what this historically is, you know, there's an interest for it. There's a Hollywood approach to it that tried and failed. But then when you leave it up to the actors and the talents, there's excellent work to be made, like this movie, for example.
I also feel like there is such a focus when it comes to this representation conversation on making like the giants fit us in, like they care about Black representation, Latinx representation, like any of this. And instead, you should do more like this movie where you have the actual people who are writing, being producing, the directing are Asian, can speak on these Asian experiences. And it doesn't feel like you are getting a bone thrown to you. Like, here you go. Here goes your representation. Now the next 10 movies we make will be only white people. Maybe one person who's mixed can be a part of it. So it really needs to bring back the want to just make your own movies. Stop trying to make Marvel movies have representation in places where they didn't. And it just doesn't work for all things, because I know that, like, from Percy Jackson, a lot of people are mad that one of the main characters is Black instead of being white, like she was in the movie that failed multiple years ago. And it's not like in situations like that. It's just like, it would be great if people were writing the movies about themselves and had more people about it or around it, instead of like going into an all white Hollywood and being the one minority on set telling your story for a bunch of white eyes.
I feel like that almost gets into the rabbit hole of like nepotism in Hollywood being the culprit of a lot of those issues too, right? Because it's really hard to get actual people behind the scenes doing the actual work. Abby's gone! Oh no, you're muted.
Dang, this is awkward. How do you leave?
Oh, now you're cutting out a little bit. He's back.
Sorry. You were like really going off, and then it's just like my computer came off. I don't know what, like, the fuck happened.
It's like, goodbye, not anymore.
Like, just have no internet, bye. Like,
No, it's just, I mean, the point I made is one of those, right? Like, nepotism in Hollywood is rampant, and to fix these problems is like you have to dismantle, like, that nepotism issue, because how do you get diverse or people behind the scenes making things that are valuable and representative of the culture, that isn't just kind of like a grab bag of like trying to please any other group or whatever else, or maybe not even that group specifically, but please like people who think they understand what representation means. And how do you do that when there's this pervasive issue of like everyone has an uncle or a grandfather or a whatever close family friend who has been in the industry that gets them that job, and all those people tend to look exactly the same.
Oh yeah.
But you know, digression. Hollywood.
I think that's a welcome point, and I don't know if you guys touched on this while I was disconnected, but you know, something that I was thinking of too is like, as you were saying that, is in addition to like the nepotism and more broadly that kind of culture of peddling influence, and more broadly, you know, Hollywood as a broader patronage network, as opposed to, you know, even a business or even like as a place where art is produced, you know, the process of filmmaking is now relegated to what's profitable and what isn't. And I'm pretty sure that, like, you know, whether it's pitching this movie or any other kind of artistic concept that I'm sure people would love to see, it's always weighed against the indeterminable concept of, but will this be profitable? And the safe bet right now is superheroes. The safe bet right now is superhero shows. And, you know, as much as they try to pump up those numbers, man, like, I don't see it being sustainable. One is, you know, in terms of like what the cult sustain, because people are clearly getting fatigued of it. And it's only the diehard fans who are kind of deluding themselves, as I've discussed in the past. But also, it's like suffocating what gets produced otherwise, what gets encouraged otherwise. And like it's like, you know, it's now that everything that isn't a superhero movie is relegated to the domain of A24 basically, and what A24 is operating on, you know, not to criticize them too harshly because they made this movie, you know, is, you know, they're counting on all of us who are sick of the market to be their loyal customers in a real, you know, application of market logic, right? And I'm not sure what the fix is to, you know, save cinema or save the arts. But there has to be some kind of shakedown of the market forces in cinema, because it's reached the point where what's artistic or what sounds interesting or what sounds fun is no longer up for question.
I think kind of on that way of thinking about while you're talking about it. So when I think about Marvel movies, right, because obviously DC is making superhero movies and they don't do nearly as well. We all know that because they're not as good. And I'm not even a big Marvel fan, but like just conceptually, a lot of them are messy, to say the least. I think, though, what's interesting on that is when I think about, I was actually talking to my supervisor about this earlier this week, funny enough, is that a lot of the movies, the Marvel movies specifically, that, and even DC technically, that do well are the ones that tend to have directors who are adding more of like their own vision, or maybe not even do well, but the ones that people fondly remember are the people, are the movies that directors are allowed to have a little more freedom, aside from ones like, you know, I don't know, Infinity War, because that one's like you're in so deep that of course you're gonna watch it, type of movie. But the ones like, the one popping in my mind right now is Thor Ragnarok. So I think that's a fun as fuck movie. Personally, I'm not even a big Marvel fan. I've never been huge into Marvel movies. I've always thought they're fine and I enjoy them enough, but I've never been super into them. And I really like Thor Ragnarok. It's a fun time, especially like casting Jeff Goldblum in that movie. Struck a genius. There it is. It's directed by Taika Waititi, which I personally had never watched any of his other movies until I had seen Thor Ragnarok. And I was like, wow, that's really good. And I took a moment to actually figure out who directed it. And it was good because he directed it. And I decided to start like looking into his other works and realizing, oh, he has movies that are way better than Thor Ragnarok, and they're way funnier, and they have a lot more to say, and they're way more stylistic. So I think, I almost wonder if, and I this is like optimistic hoping, that like if those movies tend to get more traction, if Disney will kind of loosen the chokehold on the artistic vision of a lot of these movies, and allow people to explore these directors who make interesting things. So like another one that I'm thinking of, because I'm like on it now, interesting thing. So Ant-Man, right? It's not a great movie. I'm not about to start talking about how Ant-Man's amazing. But I am going to say that it was originally supposed to be directed by Edgar Wright.
Exactly.
And it was partially directed by Edgar Wright, and then Disney kicked him off the project because creative differences or whatever. Or he left the project. It doesn't really matter. The end result is he didn't direct the whole movie. And when you watch Ant-Man, it's so interesting because it's kind of a dissonant experience, because you can tell what parts are directed by Wright and which parts were not directed by him. And I wonder if they had let Edgar Wright just direct it and do what he was going to do, make the movie he wanted to make, if that would have been one of the most well-known and most revered Marvel movies, because it had an interesting and creative flair to it. This is all a whole tangent, but I'm wondering how, if we're talking about like market forces, if those movies tend to be better and tend to stick in people's memory, if directors who prove themselves to make interesting and more compelling or more like more identifiable movies will get that attention and ability to make bigger projects, like we've seen with like Taika Waititi specifically is the one popping. You know, I like him a lot. I've been watching a lot of his stuff recently. So he's on my mind. But yeah, that's wondering if that's kind of an opening to get it away from just A24 being the only studio producing anything that is potentially interesting.
It is like one angle to consider of many, you know what I mean? And it's definitely like if a director has a lot of work outside of their one MCU project, you could then use that as like a bridge point to get an MCU addict off of the path, you know? And be like, well, hey, if you like this movie, this director does a lot of good work. And then maybe you can branch them that way. But part of me is also always scared of like, I don't think corporate America has learned its lessons from 2008. I still think that, you know, even though no one says the words too big to fail anymore, that mentality still governs their decision-making process in a way. And part of me is always afraid of like, you know, if a director gets touched by the MCU process, does that in turn affect decisions they make down the line because of the connections they get through Disney, for one? because I remember that was a criticism people levied about Jojo Rabbit, which was a Waititi project. I have not seen the movie. I'm not going to say anything, but I'm definitely going to just repeat that. I think people said that, like, he seems to have gained something from working with Disney that he didn't have before, and they didn't like it. What that is, I can't speak to that. And I think
yeah,
the
I'm
other
to figure that out. I was almost going to be firmly on my take. To be entirely honest, maybe that's controversial to say, but I don't even know what the hell that's.
Yeah, it was just, it was something I recall reading, but I have to see the movie before I can even, you know, repeat that in earnest. But I think, you know, the Edgar Wright story, I don't know if we talked about that on the MCU episode we did, but that's always a point to add too, because I know now we're on a whole Marvel Disney tangent, but I think that you know, the pull that a studio has over the creative project is one of the reasons why people hate working with Disney when they do those exit interviews or when they talk about having worked with Disney in the past. And I think with Edgar Wright, he has this very distinctive style, whether it's Shaun of the Dead, whether it's Hot Fuzz. Hot Fuzz is one of my favorite movies, low-key. I think when, you know, Disney says, hey, don't do that, it definitely rubs certain directors the wrong way, whether that's, you know, artistic freedom being impinged or whether that's someone's ego being hurt. Who's to say? But I'm definitely just, you know, now I'm just doing that thought experiment in my head of, like, what if the Daniels came to Disney with this proposal? What would have remained of the original, if even? And then what if that's just, like, you know, counterpoint? People talk about A24 as, like, kind of saving indie cinema in a way. But what if that's, like, the whole pitch? Because I was even hearing this with, you know, certain things like Avatar Publishing, which is a comics publisher, and they're known for, like, not restricting gory comics that they publish. They kind of give their authors expressive freedom, and that kind of becomes a selling point for people who want to read that kind of stuff. And I'm kind of wondering if that's a cynical tool on A24's side now, where it's like, no, our director's artistic freedom, and that's, like, a selling point for a discerning consumer rather than an honest exercise, you know, artistic expression or something.
I feel like it can be both, right? I think I definitely think it's the selling point. I think when their logo pops up, at least when I see it now, I associate it with a movie that's gonna kind of be a little more off the beaten path. It's not gonna be something I have probably seen. It's not gonna be formulaic, most likely. And you know, if they're using that to their, I guess, to get a market edge or to corner that market, I guess. As long as they're allowing their directors to continue to have that creative freedom, I don't know if I care too much if that's the selling point. If they're gonna use it as a selling point, as long as I'm getting the result of a creative person being able to show their artistic vision, especially with someone I've never heard of before, which is another thing about A24, is a lot of the movies that they come out with are from directors that I'm not totally familiar with, or haven't heard, have done projects before. And I think there's inherent value in that, right? It's similarly to the movie we're talking about, ha ha ha, circling back. It's not all, like, right or wrong or good or bad, right? Like, it can be maybe a decision that's made with not necessarily the purest intent, but not inherently be a horrible decision to be making. Like, I'm still benefiting by getting a product that, or an art piece of art that looks different than everything else. And if A24 is going to market themselves based on that, fuck it, okay. Like, as long as you're not stifling your creatives, I'm kind of fine with that. I prefer that over the other model, which is stifle your creative, the creative input directors are giving you because you want a sanitized product that fits your brand. If your brand is creative freedom, then okay. Like, sure.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, the ultimate thing is, you know, the operative word in show business, unfortunately, is business. Okay. We've been at this for, like, I want to say an hour and a half now.
Yeah, we went on a journey with this.
Yeah, we've been on a journey. I think I had something in the outline about, you know, that observation that the everything bagel is yin and the googly eyes are yang, but you know, you can, I think I retweeted that. You guys can go look at that. It's not my it's just something cool I noticed. But I guess one thing we can probably get at as we're closing down is, what was everyone's favorite
favorite what?
Favorite scene.
I think a tie between, this is kind of an odd one. So the scene with Wayman we talked about earlier, where he's talking about how he fights, it gets me, it makes me want to cry. Like, it's that like chunk of the movie, like from that bit, it's kind of cheating, but like that bit to like the part where, oh my God, wait, no, now I'm like not sure. Oh, it's the car, it's the rock scene. The rock scene is really good. And then I also really like the scene where they tie, she tries to tie Joy to a chair and claims she's gonna go crazy if she doesn't tie her to the chair, which is so funny. And like then she starts talking about the raccoon, and but then she starts fighting and all of it. Anything, I don't know. I think I like the second half of the movie maybe more than the first half. Maybe that's what I'm gonna say. I don't know. It's all so good. Shit. Someone else answered.
For me, I also feel the same. There's just so much that's great. It really is a very, very, very good movie. But one of my favorites is, well, one, I like any of the moments where she's like split in between her and like another version of her. Like, that does feel, sometimes I feel like I am like split. I'm like listening to something in my brain and like paying it, trying to pay attention to what's really in front of me, which might also go into that ADHD thing. But I also love the part where she is with business Wayman, and he tells her, and like he would have loved to do laundry and taxes with her, and like literally I want to cry just like thinking about the scene, because it's just so like she always desired something else, or like felt like she wasn't doing enough. But what you see right in front of you, like what the people that you have right in front of you and with you, that's the things that make everything worth it. And yeah, like I just want to cry.
Yeah, that bit also makes me. That's it. Yeah, that makes me cry.
That honestly, like, was, you know, what set this movie apart from me as like, oh, this is a good movie too. This is, it's providence that I saw this movie when I did, because something I've been struggling with of late, I'm not going to say I'm past it, but I'll just be open about it, is like, I struggle with that sense of like, you know, have I made all the right choices in life? What if life was different for me? And that sense of like, you know, feeling like I haven't found my purpose in life, or not knowing what I want to do, or more broadly, like feeling like deficient or like I'm a failure in some way. And this movie like is dripping in that subtext this whole time. And for it to end on that note of, it doesn't need to be this grand, showy and glamorous version of success that we impose on people. It's those, like, you know, very meaningful and simple things that we do with another, those genuine friendships we have, love that you have for someone, that's is actually meaningful in life, as opposed to, you know, any of the material success. That line, you know, is definitely like, is one of the top 10 in the movie. Was it my favorite scene in a movie with like possibly like good scenes all around? because it's still a tie between the fanny pack fight, the guys trying to get their ass on the butt plug so they can unlock powers, and I was like bound to be wet-eyed during the movie. It's like, hold it in pretty good. The one scene where I lost it, like I was actually like openly crying in the theater, the one where she's trapped in the closet and they're like pumping gas into the room to knock them out, so she does jump into the world where she becomes like an opera singer. And the kind of way in which, like, not even the choices you can make, it's also random fate that influences the outcome of your life as one of the possibilities. It was just like hidden in the subtext there. It's not in this is a movie that's focused on choice and the guilt that comes with choices. And that also just dropped in, like, oh, it's also just what happens to you randomly, by the way. And then the way they build up the music of that scene, where, like, she takes in a deep breath and is able to get the gas, and then, like, she starts singing. I don't know what the song is. I don't know what the composition is. It's such a scene where they're, like, doing, like, this beautiful-ass fight, like, choreography, and then she's singing on stage, and then all conflicts are like progressing smoothly, and then like she swallows a frog in one world and that causes her to choke up in the performance. I don't know why that scene got to me in the way it did, but it was such a beautifully and flawlessly executed scene, along with just like all these beautiful thematic elements and like the music and all that. I don't know why that got me crying, but that is the one scene I genuinely felt something for in a movie full of scenes. I felt genuinely something.
I think just on this, I want to like note this as well, because you're talking about like the value and like the what ifs and realizing that like, you just have to be like where you are. I think there's something. So the version of Evelyn that we're following is stated in the movie to be the worst version of her. Like Wayman at one point flat out says, "You are the worst version of you. Like you, there's no other version of you that's worse than this." And I think it's interesting that at the end of the movie, she and Joy have the option to be anywhere. They could pick anywhere to live. And they choose to live in the universe where Evelyn is the quote unquote worst version of herself, and just be there and enjoy each other and enjoy like being with Waymond. And I don't know, there's something to that too. It kind of ties in what Sky was saying with Line of like, I would have loved to have been doing taxes and laundry with you, right? Like it circles that back to where Evelyn finally acknowledges that's how she feels too. She could be anything in the entire world that she wants to be, and she chooses to own the laundromat and just be there with her family. And that, like, that also is like, it hits me right in the heart.
Moral of the story: it is a great movie, and everyone should watch it.
There are so many good scenes in this movie that we can't even really easily pick a good scene. I straight up cannot. Every time I think of one, I think of another one that's actually maybe my favorite. Also, the soundtrack is really good. It's on Spotify. You can listen to it. I listen to soundtracks while I work, and I highly recommend it. It's really good and easy listening. And the song Adi was talking about in the scene where she's part opera singer, part kicking everybody's ass, that song is on the soundtrack, and it is very good and very beautiful.
10 out of 10. 10 out of 10. I had to re-listen to it. Oh my god. It is such a good movie. The CIA is interfering with my internet connection to prevent me from talking about it. That's how good it is. Okay. We've been at this a minute, so that's before we move into closing out and plugs.
You won't regret watching this movie. No. I don't know. I don't have a lot of like wrapping up. Easy to package. This movie is very unpackageable. It's very hard to explain why it's so good unless you've seen it. And then after you see it, all you really want to do is gush about it, in my opinion, and most people that have watched it. Even if it's just for the sheer spectacle of the whole thing, there's a lot of practical effects, a lot of very just cool, interesting things happening. And it's even if you don't feel a profound sense of anything after watching it, the spectacle of it enough is like a reason to watch it because it's deeply entertaining. It's a decently long movie, and I did not feel like I was sitting. I didn't realize how long I'd been sitting until like I realized like I was kind of sore, and I was like, oh wait, I need to like get circulation in my legs, and I've been here for a minute. Like that's how good it is. The pacing's really great. So like it is, even if you are like, I'm not a themes person, who gives a shit? It's still fun to watch. It's still a spectacle. There's still a lot of practical effects, and the kung fu scenes are so fucking cool. So that's my, I guess, my final thoughts piece on that.
Two thumbs up. Sky, any closing thoughts from you?
It's truly so good of a movie. The relationships, the costumes, the all of the fight scenes, and like just the things that they have to do to Verstrom, like the idea of that being something. All of it. It's just so amazing. And if you're really looking for a movie that is good, go watch it or go rewatch it. If you like saw it and you're like, yeah, it was good, but like I don't remember a lot of things, just go rewatch it, and I bet you it's just gonna be even better for you because you'll be noticing a lot of like different things, and it's gonna make you again feel smart.
Yeah, I think, you know, to close this, you know, I had foreclosed the probability of ever seeing a movie again because I just convinced my, you know, these big companies have cornered the market, cinema's dead, I should, you know, relegate myself to something else. And it pleases me to say I have been taken to account and been proven wrong, as I should be every day and every time I do an episode of this podcast. And what I can say affirmatively, but it's also, in a way, the anti-Marvel movie. It was shot with a low budget, with practical effects, and isn't about what makes us all human as a that problem disappear. It's about dealing with those every day. And it's a fucking fun fuck. Well, I'm just gushing here, but there is a reason why every film person on your Twitter feed is talking about this movie, because it is a breath of fresh good, but not in a hokey or hand. It speaks to the human experience in a way that cinema has and can do still. And, you know, don't walk, run to your nearest theater. See this in person if you can. Cause a COVID super spreader event.
Do not do that.
Hack the theater.
No. Go to a matinee and hopefully other people won't be there.
Okay, I am being a little loose with this, but I'm really saying that, like, the movie cured a lot of my pessimism about films. It cured a lot of pessimism I was feeling. And while, you know, film is very limited in its power, it is a bit of a tipping point in a way. And I think if you've been on the fence about whether movies can still, you know, be meaningful and impactful, I encourage you to hop over the fence and give this one a watch. So that marks our first edition of, what do we want to call it? Movie Magic? Movie Magic with Greenhouse Gaslight. I'm your host, Adi. We were joined by Sky and Gabby today. The show. I got all the plugs and links and descriptions in the doobly-doos. Till next time, take care. Bye-bye.吹开来青苔，火。